Believe in yourself, cause it starts with you, and then everyone else will believe you too. And if it looks like you're the only believer around, just keep on believing, don't put yourself down, just believe.
Our guest this week grew up in Detroit, Michigan, and earned a Master's of Divinity from Yale Divinity School. He has been a salesman for God for 48 years and was the senior minister of First United Methodist Church of Birmingham from 1993 to 2005. Known throughout America as a phenomenal preacher and pastor, he is now the executive director of the United Methodist Union of Greater Detroit. His name, Dr. Bill Richter, and we're honored to have him as our guest. And I'm Jack Rasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. I'm Jack Rasula. This is Anything Is Possible, and we're talking to Bill Ritter, Dr. Bill Ritter, the Executive Director of the United Methodist Union of Greater Detroit. Doctor, welcome. An honor to have you.
Jack, it's good to be here.
Thank you. Can we start by talking about your childhood in Detroit and your mom and your dad?
Grew up in Detroit, born in 1940, near Northwest Side, eventually Mackenzie High School. I'm the first of two children of my parents. My mother came from a Yugoslavian immigrant family. My father from a German-Irish background. I was their first child. My father was a custodian in the Detroit Public Library system, working for at least 20 years in now what is a rather difficult place in Detroit, the Brightmore neighborhood. Remember those experiences very well. A brittle diabetic, and to some degree a diabetic who had some difficulties with alcohol. His life was shortened. He was on disability for the last 7 or 8 years of his life and died when he was 57 and when I was 27. My mother, out of necessity, went to work for the J.L. Hudson Company in Detroit. First was a contingent salesperson who sold in the boys' department and then ultimately worked her way into a position as an executive secretary on one of the top floors.
What's the biggest thing, Doctor, you learned from Mom, and the biggest thing you learned from Dad?
My father was among the most brilliant people I ever knew. However, after the 11th grade, he hopped a train with his best friend, Louis Melchi. They went to California, and he never came back, and he never finished school, and he never got a GED diploma, and that handicapped him all the rest of his life. He knew he was intelligent. He took great pride in my academic achievements. But at the same time, I think everything I gained in terms of proficiency and diplomas was to some degree, he felt a mockery of what he failed to do. Occasionally, he would catch me in an error of fact, and he would correct me, and then he'd say something like, well, you're not as bright as you think you are, or your old man isn't as dumb as you think he is. And that was fairly difficult to hear, because I really did prize and value a relationship with him. Our best times were sitting in the bleachers at Butzel Field on Myers Road watching Sandlot baseball together. My mother made an effort to get me involved in church activities. She sang in the choir at Westlawn Methodist Church. They brought me there to have me baptized. My mother joined the church the same day I was confirmed as a sixth grader. My father never joined the church, although if I was doing something on a Sunday morning, he came and sat in the balcony. My mother also enjoyed music in other forms, and I do remember times of going to concerts of the Detroit Symphony, generally, especially if there were student tickets to be had. My mother didn't care much to celebrate her Slovenian heritage, but I spent some of my early years with my grandparents because my father was overseas in Italy. And so I learned Slovenian dishes in terms of eating them. I learned Slovenian songs in terms of singing them. The cultural identification skipped a generation.
Dr. Ritter, for 47 years, you've been a salesman for God. And I might add, a great one. Tell us about God.
Tell us about God. My gosh, you really do ask large questions. On one hand, we have used words that describe the transcendency, incomprehensibility of God. Words like omniscient and omnipresent and omnipotent. On the other hand, we have tried to say that there's an intimate side of God, a relational side of God, a side of God that attempts not only to be in relationship with us, but to reach us, the seeking God, if you will. The three parables in Luke 15, the lost coin, the lost boy being the two most famous ones of them, the lost sheep being the first one, describe a God who actually comes looking for us, describes a God who is seeking after us. That's the kind of God I have tried to make known to my people, at the same time keeping this whole transcendent kind of thing in the conversation so that we don't necessarily get too chummy with God as the pal. We used to sing, "My God and I walk through the fields together. We walk and talk and jest as good friends sometimes do." But in reality, there are things that we don't know about God, things we don't understand about God. He's beyond our comprehension, and I've learned to live with the mystery.
Speaking about we don't understand or know, what's heaven like?
I wish I knew. I think, from reading in Scripture and my own understanding, that heaven is relational. I go and prepare a place, the Scripture says for us. Jesus says that to his friends on the night that he's going to die the next day. Don't be afraid. Why wouldn't they be afraid? They're scared stiff. But I go and prepare a place for you. I'll come again. I'll receive you unto myself, that where I am, you may be also. We shall be together there. Not only together with him, but together with others. How many others? Darned if I know. Nobody has asked me to define the population of heaven or the entrance requirements. But I think there's going to be some surprises there. We will be with people that we are surprised to see there. Maybe we'll be surprised to be there ourselves. But the idea that a place has been prepared talks about a relationship, and that's critical to me. A friend of mine once said, people asked him all the time, will we be able to know our loved ones in heaven? And he would give them some extended theological treatise by way of an answer. But then he said, that never seemed to satisfy people. So I've eventually turned to answering their question with another question. They would say to me, Dr. Boyd, will we be able to know our loved ones in heaven? And I would say, in response, will it be heaven if we don't?
We're talking to Pastor Bill Ritter, and I'm Jack Rasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. This is Anything Is Possible. I'm your host, Jack Rasula, and we're with Dr. Bill Ritter, known throughout America as an extraordinary preacher and pastor. Doctor, tell us about your late son, Bill Ritter, Jr.
My late son was our firstborn, the love of our life, at the time when my wife and I actually became parents and we became family. He then was followed by a sister born several years later. Bill was a stellar student. He was a good athlete. He ran track and cross country in high school, played a little football, played a little soccer, went to Michigan State University, and then went on to U of D Law School. Served on the moot court at U of D Law School, got a legal internship at the Chrysler Corporation, was highly valued by them, and graduated in the top quarter of his class, and passed the bar on his first attempt. He then went on to become an attorney in a local office in our general neighborhood. He was the low man on the totem pole in a firm that specialized in medical malpractice defense. As the low man on the totem pole, he was the one who had to go to the medical library and research all of these issues. If a doctor was being sued for messing up back surgery, Bill had to become an expert in back surgery and had to write briefs concerning it.
Doctor, let's go back to early May 1994 and the day that changed your life, your wife, Chris's wife, and your daughter, Julie's wife.
I was making a pastoral call mid-afternoon. The phone rang in the home where I was making the call. The lady of the house said, "This is for you." I answered, "It was my secretary." She said, "There's a policeman waiting here in the office. He said he would wait as long as necessary until you came back. But would I please make a phone call," she said, "and see if you'd hurry." I hurried. The last thing in the world I wanted to do was go there. The last person in the world I wanted to meet was him, because I knew that meeting a policeman in my office was not going to be good news, and I felt that it could be very bad news. For 4 months since our son had been terminated by his law firm, he'd wrestled with issues of self-worth. He also wrestled with issues relating to a diagnosis of attention deficit disorder. He was on medication from the time of that diagnosis. He was spiraling into something of a depression. We feared suicide. We had talked with him about that. We'd attempted to talk with his therapist about that. But in this instance, all of that was not enough to head it off. The policeman said to me, I'll still remember as long as I live, the exact words, "Dr. Ritter, I'm here to tell you that sometime either late last night or very early this morning, your son completed a successful suicide." I knew that the word "son" meant Bill. I knew that the word "completed" meant death. And I knew that the word "successful" seemed to me like one of the cruelest words I'd ever heard associated with such an announcement. I thought to myself, why couldn't Bill have failed? But he didn't fail, because he seldom failed at anything. He had taken his life sometime, as I said, early, late the night before or early the morning thereof.
There are 33 suicides a day in America. That's about 12,000 a year. You told me, and I quote, "I believe that the first heart to be broken at Bill's death was God's heart."
I believe that to be true. There are those who would somehow wrap God's will into the reasoning behind the suicide. I certainly do not. I do not believe that God was in any way, shape, or form the architect of Bill's choice. This was Bill's choice. It was a very painful choice. And I think the God who could step in and support us in ever so many ways following the event was in no way the God responsible for the event. As I've said in print and in sermons since, you know, eventually you're going to have to face the fact that you don't understand exactly why this happened. And when you finally come to terms with the fact that this is not a puzzle to be solved, The only way out is to start splashing forgiveness in every direction. Forgiveness on the one who took his life. Forgiveness for yourself, your spouse, your family, for anything you did or didn't do that might have affected that choice. And then ultimately, forgiveness for God for either allowing it or not doing anything to stop it. And maybe just, if you're not religious, forgiveness for circumstances which sometimes can seem so darn hard and seemingly weighted against you.
You wrote a book, Take the Dimness of My Soul Away, Healing After a Loved One's Suicide. And in the book you say you don't ever get over it, but you do get through it. How did you and Chris and Julie and other family members, loved ones, get through it?
It takes a while, and every path through the valley is different as it is difficult. It's also a very personal path. For my wife, early on, she was greatly disturbed and troubled and distressed. And whereas I simply put some of the feelings on the shelf for a time, perhaps because that's more my nature, perhaps because I had a job to do and a church to serve and people to attend to, she got stronger faster. And then as she got stronger, I began to get weaker. And so the second year was the hardest for me. Supporting us, of course, all the way through were our friends, who were wonderful, our church members, who were incredibly supportive, our faith, which supported us with the notion that, as horrible as this was not the end of life as we know it for Bill. We would not see him here, but we trusted that somehow in time there would be some kind of experience of Bill again. We did seek out a counselor, not because we were worried about our relationship, but because we had heard that 81% of the parents who lose a child to death, and especially a child to suicide, end up in divorce. At no point did we think that was going to happen to us. At the same time, you don't want to take any chances. And so we sought out a counselor who at one time was an All-American basketball player at Ohio University. His name was John Canine. He's still in the area. We saw John every Thursday at 4 o'clock. And the best thing that did for us, it gave us the knowledge that whatever came up during the week that we weren't quite ready to talk about or couldn't quite handle, 4 o'clock would come around, and in a safe environment in John's office, we could raise it and work through it. Finally, he said to us after several months, he said, I don't mind taking your, whatever it was, $85 an hour, but I think you've moved beyond the need for seeing me every week. That was kind of strange for me to hear, but it was good for me to hear. So we cut to once every 2 weeks and once every 3 weeks and terminated it completely.
We're talking to Pastor Bill Ritter, who also in his book states, the best way to honor the dead is to love the living. And I'm Jack Rasul, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. Welcome back to Anything Is Possible. I'm Jack Rasula, and we're with Dr. Bill Ritter, who was the senior minister of First United Methodist Church of Birmingham from 1993 through 2005. Doctor, we've just celebrated Thanksgiving. What does Thanksgiving mean to you, Bill Ritter?
Well, of course, there was a time in my life, and as is the case with many of us, when Thanksgiving meant family gathering, when Thanksgiving meant a big feast, when Thanksgiving meant playing nice with even the most difficult of relatives, when Thanksgiving meant early on Detroit Lions football, when Thanksgiving meant the parade. Those are still big parts of my life. I take grandchildren to the parade, took my son-in-law and daughter to the Lions game a couple years back. I hate to give up those traditions. It also, however, becomes a time in which you reflect on the deeper things of your life and the ways in which you have been blessed, which you might not have seen or understood to be blessings at the time.
Holidays are either the happiest of times or the loneliness of times. If there's a listener tonight that's really down, what do you say to that person?
Well, I can tell you one of the things we did in the church I served, and this is now being replicated in a number of churches across the area. On the evening of December 21st, we developed what we called a longest night service. And we sent letters to everybody who had been through a really difficult time in the year just passed, had lost somebody in the year just passed, and acknowledged that the holidays indeed might be challenging and to some degree blue. And so those people came together. We had a service, sometimes simply acknowledging the reality of what people were feeling was a way that helped people get through those feelings and the situation. Then we'd have a reception afterward, and in some of those years, the sanctuary was filled. I can also tell you what happened the first Thanksgiving after Bill's death, if that would be of interest to you. Our therapist said to us, you need to face the holiday and not retreat from it, and you need to identify something that you will do during the course of the holiday to memorialize your son's life and or death. He said, if you do that, if you schedule it, then knowing that you're going to do that will strangely allow you to reclaim the rest of the day. I thought, well, that's just a trick you're going to play with your mind. But it actually worked. I think the first Thanksgiving, we agreed that as a family, we were going to go to the cemetery. And we did. First Christmas, we decided the thing that we would do for the memorialization of our son was that we would spend a half hour sorting pictures for a scrapbook. Strangely enough, knowing that we had scheduled an activity that was related to our pain enabled us to at least gain some access to the rest of the pleasure assorted with the day.
You're a man of faith. You're a man of prayer. If someone says, Doctor, how should I pray?
Interesting question, because it's not a matter of postures, knees, no knees, folded hands, open hands, hands upraised, hands at your side, whatever posture works for you. Adopt it and use it. If no posture works, don't use any. But I would say to people, first of all, if you're looking for a reference point, read some of the Psalms, because the Psalms are not necessarily a collection of happy, buoyant, joyful prayers, although there are some Psalms that are clearly oriented toward praise. The Psalms are filled with lament and personal pain and anguish. There is grief in the Psalms. Somebody who's coming and asking me about how to pray isn't just asking this academically. They're asking it because it's a very personal issue in their life. And the Psalms are full of people who have very personal issues in their life. And then I tell them that it's okay to articulate that issue before God in any words that you choose to employ, as long as they're honest and as long as they come out of the core of who you are and what you're feeling and what's going on in your life.
What do you say to someone who says, I pray, but God isn't answering my prayers?
The Psalms are full of that kind of lament, too. Read the Psalms, and you'll find any number of people in the Bible who said, is anybody listening to me? Are you listening to me? If you're listening to me, why aren't you doing anything for me? I really believe that getting it out is the first step in getting a response. Now, sometimes the response is no. Whether you hear that articulated cleanly or whether it comes as just an absence that sounds like no, not everything we pray for gets readily answered. As a person who wrestles with God's will a lot, I often sense the directing, willful hand of God in the rearview mirror. In other words, I get it long after the fact. I don't get it clearly at the moment.
We're talking to Dr. Bill Ritter, the author of Take the Dimness of My Soul Away, which chronicles the suicide of his son, Bill Jr. Okay. One recurring word in your book, Doctor, is grace. Talk to us about grace.
Grace is associated with gift and associated with God's gift, and is related to the question of whether or not this gift comes as a result of something we've earned or deserved, or whether it comes freely and undeservedly. Grace is generally associated, when we talk about grace, as something that we haven't earned, something that comes as a result of not measuring up, but nonetheless seeking God's presence in our life. The hymn that everybody loves to hear sung, if not loves to sing, Amazing Grace, how sweet the sound that saved a wretch like me. I still remember the woman in one of my early churches who came up to me and said, I can't sing that. I said, Hazel, why can't you sing that? She said, because I don't feel wretched, she says. And yet I'm not sure she was being entirely honest, because there are days in which, if we take a personal inventory, either by virtue of our behavior or by virtue of our spiritual condition, we are closer to wretchedness than almost anything else.
We're talking to Pastor Bill Ritter, and I'm Jack Rasul, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. I'm Jack Rasula. This is Anything Is Possible, and we're talking to Dr. Bill Ritter, phenomenal preacher, pastor for close to 50 years. Doctor, you mentioned that you fight the will, and you see the will in the rearview mirror. There's a saying, let go and let God. Surrendering, trusting is so hard for me personally, and most all of us. What advice do you give us?
Surrendering is really difficult because, of course, all of us prize self-control. People say to us, get yourself together, get control of yourself, and we take that to heart, and we not only want to control ourselves, we want to control our environment, we want to control other people, and yet, there are so many wonderful things that happen when we can let down our attempts at control and allow other things to move in upon us, influence us, shape us, mold us. People move into our lives. Christine Larson of Novi moved into my life. I wasn't looking for her to move into my life. That Sunday morning, I wasn't looking for anybody to move into my life that Sunday morning. But there she was. And there were conversations at the close of the service. And there was a date the following Tuesday. And then I began to sense that something was happening. Something was building over which I didn't have a whole lot of control. And Jackie was incredibly delightful. Most of the major things that have happened in my life were when I simply said yes to something or someone. Yes to Christine on July 2nd, 1966, at about 3:20 in the afternoon. Yes to my bishop when he laid hands on my head and ordained me. Yes to superintendents who appointed me to four churches. Yes to a divinity school dean who said, I know you live in Detroit, but would you like to figure out a way to come to Durham, North Carolina, and teach preachers at Duke? Yes to an invitation to serve the United Methodist Union. I was coming for a two-week interim and ended up, I'm now in my fifth year with this organization. And yes to God. I'm not sure that I can cite the moment I said yes, but I did surrender much of my self-will about what I was going to do and where I was going to go and how much I was going to make and all of that kind of thing. And it all has worked out exceedingly well for me.
Speaking of accepting, I'm amazed at the number of couples that I know, great couples with 2, 3, 4 kids, and they refer to one child as their prodigal child. What do you say to them, Pastor?
Oh, my gosh. Wish there was an easy answer, as with most of the questions you ask, because they're great questions. There are no ready and easy answers. Lots of things play upon the growing life of children and teens. I suppose there are some challenges that are genetic. I suppose there are some challenges that are physical and spiritual. Some are educational. A lot of the challenges are related to peers and pressures that kids face. We were talking in the car on the way over here that one of the challenges that some kids face in their growing up years is the fact that they grow up in a split household. I have a friend who is serving in a pastoral area, and he says the square mile around his church, he names the number of kids that are living there. He says there's not a single kid living in a two-parent household. But when you've got even the great families, when they have the prodigal kid, you hang in there, you try and relate the loving acceptance with the tough love kind of message. I never resonated strongly to the tough love proponents because every time I listen to them speak, they seem to emphasize the word tough more than the word love. But sometimes you do have to set certain kinds of limits and let people face certain kinds of realities. The father of the prodigal son did let him go and let him make his life in the far country. And the far country is not always measured by miles. Some people enter a far country that's just a bedroom away, a block away, a town away. Who knows? But the father somehow was like Tom Baudet of the Motel 6 commercials. You know, we'll keep the light on for you. And I think that's where it really is.
What's the difference between parenting and grandparenting?
Oh, grandparenting. That's delightful. I have Jacob who's... And parenting was delightful, too. I wouldn't want to go back and do that over again. But grandparenting... Jacob is 5 and Georgia is 3. And they love their Nina, who is my wife, and they love their Papa. That's me. We've now gone to Disney World 4 times in a row with them. We'll go for the 4th time this coming February. Just experiencing the world again afresh through their eyes is incredible. Plus the fact that you get to send them home. Jacob came for his first sleepover the other day, and we have a wonderful time getting to see him apart from his sister and apart from his family, because he's just beginning to blossom.
Dr. Bill Ritter, as our time winds down tonight, would you please lead us in a prayer of thanksgiving?
Oh, God, Frank Sinatra and his record notwithstanding, few of us have really done it my way. And those of us that have tried have found the results less than satisfying. And so we pause to give you thanks for others who have helped shape the road we have walked and the way we have traveled. Parents, siblings, relatives and friends, trusted teachers and mentors, other people who have come upon us, sometimes surprising us by what they have done for us and by what they have said to us. We give you thanks that in ways that we can't fully grasp sometimes at the moment, you have been in the making and the molding and the shaping and directing business. Find us where we are, touch us as we are, lead us where you would have us go. Amen.
Dr. Bill Ritter, for 48 years, you've been teaching us God's way and doing a phenomenal job at it. Keep it up.
Thank you, Jack.
Please join us next Sunday. Until then, I'm Jack Rasula. Thanks for listening. And make it a great week, because with God, anything is possible. Spohom.